for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama authorizes sending 450 additional troops to Iraq to help combat ISIS. In Turkey, the governing party loses its majority in parliament, and a Chinese court sentences a former security chief to life in prison for corruption. Here for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Shane Harris of The Daily Beast, Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya, and Tom Bowman of NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dan.
Tom Bowman, how much of a shift is President Obama's announcement of 450 advisors to Iraq?
You know, it's really not much of a shift, Diane. It's adding some more trainers. We were told initially there'd be roughly hundreds more trainers. Actually, now we're learning most of those people will be security personnel for the roughly 50 trainers going to Anbar province to this base called Takadum, which, interestingly, was an old Marine base that I visited years ago. They called it TQ. So they'll be going there in the coming weeks and months, training up the Sunni tribes, trying to get them to take part in the fight against ISIS. Now, heretofore, there haven't been many Sunnis fighting. You know, they see the Iraqi government as one that's mistreating them, or at least ignoring them. So it's trying to pull this country together in a unified way, get the Sunnis on board fighting ISIS. That is the challenge.
But isn't there a danger that those 450 are going to be perhaps in the sight lines of, say, some ISIS fighters who may come along knowing Americans are there?
Well, they'll be set in this base, again, called Takadum. It's a somewhat remote base. There could be rocket fire into the base. I know there have been some rocket fires into the other base where there are U.S. troops in Anbar called Al-Assad. But again, these are huge bases. There is some rocket mortar fire, let's say, but at this point, U.S. troops have been hurt or killed here. So there's a remote possibility that, a rocket could come in and kill some Americans. But at this point, no, they're not going to be leaving that base as far as we know at this point.
Not yet.
The mission, I think, also being criticized, or rather this tactic, rather than a shift of strategy, as Tom said, is because it's focus on Sunni tribes in Anbar, in this camp in particular, but also that these advisors, by the way, it's only 110 who's going to train the Iraqi army, the rest is going to be as a security and logistics. But their mission is not to go with the Iraqi army, just initially was done during the invasion of 2003. So they're really limited. They're not going to call airstrike. They're not going to have Apache helicopter. So President Obama has been very clear, actually, from day one. And he said, when the Iraqi army had been trained by us, they did well. And he gave examples of Haditha and Biji and Sinjar Mountain, etc. And when they were not trained very well by us, they did badly, like in Ramadi. But he was forced, I think the strategy was, he was forced to change it in a way, or to change the tactic within the strategy after the fall of Ramadi. That was a disaster for everyone.
And what the hope is to take back Ramadi, is it?
That's
not
a hope, to take Ramadi, but the White House won't put a deadline on it. And the key point here is to train the Sunni tribes, is to get them involved, because the Kurds have the Peshmerga, the Iraqi army, mainly dominated by Shiite militia and the popular forces. The Sunnis are the one who left out, and they're the one who are able to fight Daesh because they are Sunnis.
And this puts now a total of what, about 3,500 U.S. troops in that area?
That's right. About 3,500 so far. And as Tom said, they're really not necessarily in immediate danger given the positions that they've been in, and they're not taking a direct combat role. And I think we've trained upwards of about 9,000, or maybe it's a little bit higher than that, of Iraqi forces as well. You know, I think one of the real challenges here is going to be, though, reaching out to these Sunni groups and getting them to take part. On paper, that sounds like a great thing, but practically speaking, that's going to be a huge challenge because of these sectarian rifts between Sunni and Shiites that have been at the conflict, or heart of the conflict in Iraq, for so many years.
And how does the Pentagon think that they can turn the Sunnis around, Tom?
Well, it depends who you talk with. I mean, the official line is this is an effort to bring the Sunnis on board. The retired Marine General John Allen has been over there working with both the government and the Sunni tribes. He's worked out something with the government where you can earmark weapons for the Sunni tribes. It'll all go through the government. They'll be located at places within Anbar province, so they have weapons. He's working with the tribes to bring them on board for training. So you have a retired Marine general from the United States basically as the go-between with the government in the Sunni tribe. So many people would say, what's wrong with that picture? Can this country stay together? And you're seeing a lot more people talk about that privately and a little bit publicly. General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, basically said, listen, the government has to do more. They have to unify this country. If they can't do that, he just said this to reporters, and he said it to us maybe several months ago, if they can't do this, we have to look at other options, working with other partners. He didn't say who that is, presumably, I don't know, Jordan, Turkey, others to go after ISIS. So this is a real wake-up call, they say, for the Iraqi government. If you can't keep this country together, it may just eventually split apart.
And how about our allies? Anybody else going in there with us?
At the time being, I mean, the White House would like to say we have 62 countries who are on board with us, but really the main brunt of the whole mission is by the U.S. Although the airstrikes has not been as effective as everybody thought, it's only a quarter of the air power that costs the U.S. $9 million a day, has not been kind of targeting Daesh also in an open area in the desert. But I think, Diane, the point here to stress is the sectarian politics has exacerbated a very bad situation from the beginning. When Prime Minister Maliki took over, the army makeup of Shiite was 60%. By the time he left, it was almost 90%. He did a purge against all the top leader commanders of the Iraqi army. And by the way, most of the people who fight with ISIS or Daesh are the former Ba'athist military who worked under Saddam Hussein. They're the one who had the experience. They're the one who has the military brilliant mind of planning where to go and how to do attacks, etc. It's not just by ISIS, by the way. So the problem now is how to get these people on board. When they demanded their rights in the riots in April, it was peaceful, by the way. Maliki went after them. He jailed their political leaders. He put them in imprisonment. He also exiled them. So the whole idea of how do you trust this government? Mm-hmm. Now, the White House thinks Prime Minister Abadi is much better than Maliki, and we were willing to work with them. And they still believe in a unified Iraq within the framework of working with the army. Although everybody knows that Iran has been fundamental and instrumental in funding and training the Shiite militia.
And I think President Obama kind of put a fine point on another aspect of this problem at the G7 summit this week, where he said it's the flow of foreign fighters going into Syria, going into Iraq, that are basically allowing them to ISIS to replenish its ranks faster than we can destroy them. And we don't have a competent Iraqi military on the ground, so right now the airstrikes are the only game. And I know we're going to talk about Turkey in a second, but he specifically called out President Erdogan for this and saying Turkey is not doing enough to police its borders, and these foreign fighters are coming in and flowing in and basically creating a status quo. We kill a bunch of ISIS people, they come right back, they're replenished yet again in the stocks.
And that's something John Allen, the retired Marine general, is working on as well, working with Turkey, with Saudi Arabia, trying to stop the flow of foreign fighters, the financing of ISIS. And at this point, as the president said, there's still a problem with Turkey, with ISIS troops and arms flowing across the Turkish border. It's a huge problem. So as we were talking with a senior Air Force officer who talked about the bombing campaign and how effective it is, he said we're taking 1,000 ISIS fighters off the battlefield each month. Meanwhile, they're flowing in from Turkey and other areas.
That's true, but let me say something. I'm not sure if it's right or wrong, that most of the foreign fighters are actually in Syria, not in Iraq. And this White House does not have any strategy of dealing with ISIS in Syria. And that's a big elephant in the room. And everybody said these borders are open. They go all the way from the west of Anbar to Raqqa. So if you're not willing to fight them in Syria, it's obvious that they're going to come back to Iraq. And most of the training camp are there. They're running a state, Diane. They're running schools and hospitals and courts and life is normal under civilian population. Take Mosul, for example, let alone Syria. It's the second largest city in Iraq with 2 million people. It's been 1 year anniversary since the fall of Mosul, and we're just talking about, are they taking back Ramadi? I mean, good luck. If it's a city like Mosul, they were unable to take it, and some generals saying, including Dimzi, by the way, who said Anbar, maybe it's a later stage, it's not a priority. It fell, it was a shock. They said, what the heck has happening? And now they're revising.
And meanwhile, we're talking about training up the Iraqi forces. Roughly 8,000-9,000 have been trained so far. So everyone asks, well, what about a ground force for Syria? Well, they're training up moderate rebels. They started with 90 in Jordan and another 90 in Turkey.
Yeah, it's basically a non-existent rebel force, isn't it? And I mean, and you're finding some of these same issues happening now in Iraq with the training. I mean, we've been talking to people saying our trainers are basically sitting over in Iraq with not very much to do. So for different reasons, we're having comparable difficulties scaling up the forces that we need to actually fight this war. Those are the boots on the ground, not ours.
Shane Harris, he's with the Daily Beast. Pardon me, not yet, Bill Basie. Of Al Arabiya, Tom Bowman of NPR. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happened in Turkey, both politically and militarily.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. From Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And from the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts.
And welcome back. Here's our first email from Pat in Washington, D.C., who identifies himself as a Vietnam veteran and a strong supporter of President Obama in 2008 and 2012. But I wish he would level with the American public and say, number one, the Iraq War was a mistake. It led to the current ISIS crisis, and the U.S. cannot turn things around in 10 weeks or 10 years. Iraq must do it for themselves.
Well, I think in some ways President Obama has said some of those things. I mean, he came into office saying that the war was a mistake and promising to end it. Now, I think where he's, you know, the emailer has a strong point here is that has the president unnecessary or unrealistically set expectations that we're going to be able to destroy and defeat and degrade ISIS, as he says? You know, that is sort of the talking point. But if you listen to other things that he says, you know, this is going to be a multi-year project. This is going to last for a couple of years. The translation of that is this is going to be the next president's problem. And I think that this White House has decided it has to manage the crisis as it is and is not under any illusions that it will be able to turn things around. This is going to be the top issue, I think, in foreign policy in the presidential campaign. Every candidate is going to have to answer the question, what would you have done differently? Will you put boots on the ground? How are you going to fight ISIS?
And, Shane, let's move from there to President Erdogan's party in Turkey. It lost its majority in parliament, now has to form a coalition. So what are the prospects for prolonged instability in Turkey?
Yeah, there's sort of a big question mark over Turkey right now because, I mean, the party, and really Erdogan wasn't on the ticket, but the party was. And what he failed to do in this was secure the necessary seats in parliament that he would have needed to make changes to the constitution that would have given him even more power than, frankly, he has already taken, far more power than the presidency in Turkey usually allows. So this was a really stunning rebuke, I think, of him by liberals, by Kurds, by secular people in Turkey. So now the question is, will a coalition government form? You already hear Erdogan's party and the prime minister saying, well, Turkey doesn't have a great history with coalition governments. The part of the parties that gained some seats are clearly feeling that victory and talking about it, but they have 45 days to form one now. I don't think it's at all clear as of today what is going to happen there.
So what are the aims of the Kurdish party?
This is the greatest victory, I think. It shows that with all the struggle for the Kurdish rights in Turkey, they managed to do it through the ballot box. And it's a good example for the rest of the Middle East and the Arab world. So we have this new party that emerged. It was a gamble for them, by the way. They called the HDP. It's led, which is the People Democratic Party. It's led by this charismatic lawyer. His name is Salahuddin Demirtas. He managed to expand his base beyond the Kurdish votes to include liberals and women and young people, and even here, he fielded a gay candidate. And they managed to get more than 10%, and for the first time ever, they will have seats in the parliament. But at the same time, it's going to be very hard for President Erdogan to have a coalition with them, because lately he's been on and off with this peace deal with the Kurds, especially with the PKK. So if he goes with them, he might alienate people in his base who been ultra-nationalist. They don't want to have any peace talks with the Kurds, etc. But for them, it was a great day and a victory. Glorious day, actually, for small parties.
And not only did they get Kurdish votes with this party, but they also got liberals within the country who were worried about the dictatorial moves of the president. And so that was a big factor, too, I think.
But is there a way that Erdogan could somehow mess up the works by objecting to, say, one coalition after another instead of being a force for change?
Yeah, and under the rules, he could do that, right? I mean, he could essentially try and run the clock out on this.
Yep.
And use this as a power grab for himself, sure.
He could call for new elections as well. Yep. End of the summer, into the fall.
Well, he needs 45 days to give the parties to get together. And I think there is a chance that they might call for an early election. There is a chance that they have, I mean, the options here is to have a minority government. But I think for him, it's even riskier because people were really tired of his authoritarian
yes.
style of government. Turkey is too big and diverse.
Give us some examples of his authoritarian.
I mean, more than just authority. It's actually many folds. But number one for that, for example, he cracked down on journalists. Nobody is able to criticize him. He closed down Twitter and the social media. He silenced his opponent. He's trying to cover up this, what he's been accused of, this economic corruption scandal, financial scandals involving high-ranking members within the AKP and within even his son. There is millions of dollars always hidden in his house, etc. And he took a stand against the military. I mean, some people say that, of course, the military has been too powerful in Turkey. Even his party has been dubbed. Of course, the latest was this demonstration in the gas in the park in out of Taksim Square, which is basically he wanted to take the last piece of green and build on it. So his party is called the Justice and Development Party, and he's been dubbed as Development and Development Party. Whoa. He did great for the working class. He did great for the conservative and the pious, who constitute the base of his support. If you go in Turkey outside of Istanbul and the major cities, actually you can see the development that happened there, and people has benefited from the stability. Definitely for decades almost, from the 90s to 2000, when the government, we all remember the Prime Minister Bulent Ecevit, who always been a struggle with his coalition. There was bickering within the political parties, there was a financial crisis, corruption, etc. So people looked up to the AKP, but they criticized him for being too big for his ambition.
So given that Turkey is a NATO ally, how is this going to affect what happens in the region, Tom?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. I mean, one of the issues, of course, is what we've just been talking about, ISIS. How will they train more of these moderate Syrian rebels? They're still calling for a buffer zone along their border with Syria. What impact will that have? At this point, we really don't know.
Well, I think Turkey has played a role recently, I think with the approval of the GCC countries and the Americans. If you look at in Syria, it has been a series of victory for the rebels in the Idlib province. They almost liberated it from the regime. Today, there is an assault on from the southern front on the Druze area. Many people believe that this Jesh al-Fateh, which is constituted mainly from Jabhat al-Nusra, although considered the terrorist group and affiliate of al-Qaeda and other radicals like Ahrar al-Sham and else of the other groups, they actually have been making a huge gain in Idlib. And many people believe that that's because Turkey has allowed some weapons, quality weapons, to go to them, and more training has been happening to trying to weaken the regime to the degree that maybe they will force him to negotiate.
All right. And Shane, the Wall Street Journal reported this week that U.S. officials say a spy virus that targeted Iran nuclear talks was linked to Israel.
That's right. So this is sort of we have to go back and remember something called the Stuxnet virus, which was developed a few years back by Israel and the U.S. to attack an Iranian nuclear facility. A sort of offshoot of that was this computer virus called Dooku. Just strange names. These sound like Star Wars characters, I know. But it's this virus is associated with Israeli cyber spying operations. And a sort of second, more sophisticated variant of this was discovered by a security company called Kaspersky, which is based in Russia. And is used widely around the world. They found this had been used and implanted in the networks of at least three hotels where the P5 plus one members were gathering to talk with the Iranians about the nuclear deal. And in this really sophisticated and kind of stunning array of capabilities, they were able to apparently tap into phones, turn on microphones on computers, download surveillance footage from the hotel cameras, really sort of just have eyes and ears remotely inside these facilities. And it does tie back to Israel. There's been a lot of research
but
linking
they're
that.
Denying.
Oh, sure.
They are denying it. That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. And it's interesting how this came about, that the American intelligence was intercepting Israeli communications, and they heard the Israelis talking about what they picked up from these meetings. So it really is the old spy versus spy.
Absolutely.
And the fact, this all comes down to also your own security, too, and the fact that you're negotiating with the Iranians at these hotels in Switzerland. Apparently, Switzerland has opened an investigation. Don't you think maybe certain countries would be interested in intercepting your communications and your documents? So where was the security in the U.S. part?
Yeah, that's a question, exactly. Too. And one hopes that that we were coming equipped with some better security than the hotels had.
Apparently not.
You know, I think the surprising thing here to me would have been if the Israelis were not spying on these meetings, right? I mean, this is just, as Tom said, classic kind of spy versus spy, but shows you the extent to which Israel has developed a very sophisticated cyber spying operation, that they're able to do this now with these highly engineered computer viruses that can't just be up by anybody in a basement. I mean, these are really sophisticated, expensive things.
So what kind of information was gleaned, do we know?
Well, we know that what it was designed to do, which was to be able to get into a computer, steal files off the computer, turn the camera or the microphone on the computer on, listen to the hotel's phones, get in the hotel Wi-Fi, get into the hotel's security camera. Mm-hmm. And the important thing is, once a virus like this gets in, it's how does it then extract the information and get it out without anyone seeing it? And one of the really interesting features of this Dooku virus is that it leaves nearly no trace. It was very, and the only reason this particular one got discovered was the security research company that discovered the first variant of it found out it had been hacked, probably by the Israelis who wanted to know what they knew about it.
And the bottom line is, why would you do this? And clearly the Israelis are trying to get information about the talks. What are the negotiations? What are they saying? Glean that information, collect it, and go to their allies in Congress and the United States and say, this is what they're saying. We don't like it. Help us sideline this whole effort.
Yeah, and on more than that, actually, a senior U.S. official, if it was not even Secretary Kerry, who won in March, Diane. If you remember, the Wall Street Journal broke the story that in March, saying that basically the Israelis were spying on the talks in Geneva and even in Austria, because the Austrians also opened an investigation. The negotiation was in Geneva and Lausanne, in Montreux, and also in Austria. So they know about it. And it was obvious, as everybody says, the Israelis wanted to know, even if they don't have have to use it later on. I think they needed to know what's going on because they don't trust any party there.
The FBI has not absolutely concluded that it was Israel.
No. As far as I know, they have not. But again, their investigations are ongoing. But again, it gets back to the issue of your own security for communications. Who was doing that for the U.S. side? What happened? And I haven't seen many stories on that. Are people even asking the questions? How could this happen? Who was in charge of security for the American side?
Well, one wonders, and this is just purely speculating on my part, but why not? One wonders if we did know something like this was going on, great, let the Israelis spy on it. Then we don't have to, right? I mean, we can sort of glean information from them. You know, John Brennan made a trip to Israel last week to meet with some of his counterparts. I wonder what they talked about.
All right, and let's us talk about Greece. The IMF has pulled its negotiators out of the Greek bailout talks. That seems pretty important. Why did they do it, Nadia?
Well, Greece is a saga that's going to continue.
It's a saga.
I mean, the European Central Bank has boosted their three banks, actually, in Greece because they're running out of money and the depositors are saying, look, we're going to take our money back. They have a deadline on June 30th that they have to pay back this IMF loan, which is $1.6 billion. They have a left-wing prime minister who's trying to negotiate with the two superpowers in Europe, if you wish, you know, with Angela Merkel, German chancellor, and with President Hollande, and saying, like, maybe we can extend the time, maybe we can wait till March, etc. But people are just kind of losing patience with Greece. And the problem, too, is they have even a ruling. So they're basically saying, if we're going to implement the austerity measures that the IMF has imposed on us, we're going to lose because the economy is going to stall, there is no growth. And the court, to add, you know, insult to injury and to complicate even things further, the court, they ruled that the pension, they cannot cut pension. Yeah. So they have to come up with this deficit in the money, which is, I think, $1.5 billion as well. And they cannot raise taxes because they don't want to raise taxes. So they're really stuck. And if they wanted to stay in the Eurozone, then they have to oblige by this the IMF terms.
And then the question is, where does this go? Do they just pull out of the Eurozone eventually?
Or? Been talking about this for 3 years, I guess, now. Even on this show.
Does that look more likely now?
Well, that's one of the questions people have. If they're not going to pay their debts, if these negotiators actually walk out on them, where does this leave this whole thing?
Where
that's the question.
Does it leave us indeed? And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's now go to China corruption. China handed down a life sentence to a former top security chief for corruption. What do you do, Shane?
Right. Well, the allegations here are that he intentionally disclosed national secrets, which has never been quite defined, as I've seen it in the charges, but also that he was engaged in bribery and abuse of power, sort of enriching himself based on his official position, which is a series of cases that we've seen of this in China. And there has been this big effort to round up high-ranking officials and prosecute them and show that they are not above the law. What was really interesting in this case is that it seemed like the Chinese journalists who were decamped outside of this place where he was going to be tried, we're expecting a long trial, and suddenly we found out, nope, he's decided to go ahead and plead guilty to it, and he's announced he doesn't want to appeal. What this very much looks like is that he cut some kind of a deal and spared the Chinese government the potentially huge embarrassment that would have occurred if he starts talking about all of these nebulous plots and these affairs that might implicate other officials.
But is he really going to spend the rest of his life in prison?
Well, we'll see what happens, but this is an effort by the Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, to go after what he calls tigers and flies of corruption within his own party. He's very serious about it, and this is a big pelt on the wall, I would think, for any Chinese official looking at this guy potentially going to jail for life to think twice about corruption.
Yeah, actually, the Chinese tweeters already said, you know, you put the tiger in the cage, referring to him, because he was considered one of the strongest men in China. And it is just, you know, to see somebody who I think it might be even the first as the head of the security ministry to be tried under the Communist Party since 1946, I think. It's that big.
But there is a whole anti-corruption campaign.
Right, because as Tom said, the president has been leading that. Exactly, he's trying to clean up.
And so they'll go after many others?
Presumably, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that was interesting, one of the visuals from this whole spectacle was this individual, Xiao Yongkang is his name. He shows up in the court with this sort of graying, sort of white hair. And you see pictures of him when he was in office, and these high-ranking officials frequently dye their hair to the kind of almost black. And so obviously the hair dye has been taken away since he's been in jail. And showing up in public now with this white hair is seen as this fall from grace in China. So like the visual displays of this were really quite stunning. And to see him sort of, you know, penitent and contrite and put up there on stage, you know, humiliated in front of the public, that's a message that the government is trying to send, and it's doing it with these sort of subtle visual cues,
and
too.
And actually, it's the case of most dictators. If you see Saddam Hussein, too, during his trial, so they lose the dye and they look undignified in a way.
How old is this?
70-something.
70-something. Yeah. So life in prison. Well, short break here, and when we come back, it's time to open the phones. I see many of you want to talk about Iraq, the Middle East, and we'll get to your calls as quickly as possible.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, from Carbonite, providing secure and automatic backup and recovery for businesses and homes. Since 2005, Carbonite has recovered nearly 40 billion files for its customers, from accounting databases to family photos. Learn more at carbonite.com. And from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world whose stories take us there every day.
Ornette Coleman, the jazz alto saxophonist, composer, and revolutionary figure in the avant-garde, has died at the age of 85. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to interviews from our archive with Coleman, his son Donardo, and two musicians who played in Coleman's band, trumpeter Don Cherry and bassist Charlie Hayden. Join us.
Welcome back. Time now to go right to the phones. Let's go first to Jonathan in Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. What I wanted to talk to you about, and just the callers, was a question of just how American policy and really, quite frankly, global policy towards the Middle East for the past 100 years has been very resource, and oil-centric, and we've seen that that's just resulted in countless crisis upon crisis in terms of just the humanitarian cost. And I'm just wondering, when will global leaders step up and reconsidering how they approach the Middle East?
I really have no idea when they're going to do that. I mean, there are a number of issues that are important. The security of Israel, oil, as you mentioned, is very, very important. We had a former Ambassador Ryan Crocker on All Things Considered, and he was talking about splitting up Iraq and what a disaster that would be, because basically Iran would subsume Shiistan, and they would get most of the oil there. That's a big concern in people's minds.
Let's go to Christopher in North Bloomfield, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Love your show.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask, it was kind of addressed a little bit in the last question, but of promising the Sunni and the Kurds their own statehood as a way of developing a strategy against ISIS. You know, Iraq has promised that they would be inclusive, but instead they have been exclusive. And I know the Sunnis don't trust the Iraqi government, and I feel we could get more support against ISIS if we would make this sort of appeal to Sunnis.
Well, I think this goes back to what we were talking about at the top of the show, about this now, this new strategy of reaching out to the Sunni groups and trying to bring them in to the fight against ISIS. I mean, the administration does not want to see the country divided into three parts, even though everyone understands that is a very big potential outcome of this whole conflict. But this is where the administration seems to be betting right now, is on bringing these groups back in and trying to form some cohesion, whether that be around a national military or maybe even some of these militia groups, but trying to find some common purpose in fighting ISIS. That's really kind of the new element of the strategy here.
And to Dayton, Ohio, Ibrahim, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate the chance to be on your show.
Sure.
My family and I, we are big fans of yours.
Thank you.
I came back 2 weeks ago from actually a trip to Syria, and if you have any question, I'd be happy to answer. But my question was about the ISIS. I'm kind of really shocked how such kind of a group of people could really expand despite the airstrikes that we have. And I was very concerned also about that declassified information that was, you know, the U.S. has some roles. I was, you know, I couldn't believe that this could be true. But if you can cover that topic about declassified information.
I don't know what declassified information you're talking about.
There was some declassified information from the intelligence agency that there is some role of U.S. of training and even possibly arming. And, you know, there was many times, like Wesley Clark, there was YouTube about mentioning that we may have indirectly really helped those group of people.
Tom.
Well, I don't know about helping those people, but I can tell you about airstrikes. The question was, why haven't airstrikes had more of an impact? There have been more than 4,000 airstrikes. It sounds like a lot, but experts like retired Lieutenant General Dave Deptula say, listen, this is only a drizzle of airstrikes. Airstrikes should be thunder and lightning, and you're just not doing enough. You should do more. But the Obama administration will tell you, listen, we're really worried about civilian casualties. We're really worried about friendly fire incidents. So we're being very, very careful about how we use airstrikes.
All right. To Sally in Middletown, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Regarding ISIS, Syria, Iraq, Republicans in Congress keep saying, what is President Obama's plan, or Obama's not doing enough? The Republicans are constantly criticizing, but why don't they just debate on the Presidential Authorization Act for military force, offer real suggestions, or is it politically safer to let Obama make all the decisions, suffer the consequences, while the Republicans in Congress play it safe and keep criticizing from the sidelines?
Actually, we took that up in the last hour, but go ahead, Nadia.
Well, it's a good point, absolutely. I mean, they can criticize, they can suggest. I mean, I think Lindsey Graham has already said that 10,000 troops should be sent, and the president has to change the strategy. But yes, they haven't even authorize him to use military force, and that will be extended to 3 or 5 years. But saying that, I think the administration could have done more from the beginning, whether it's in Iraq or in Syria in particular. I don't think we would have reached that situation. But let's remind everybody that the reason we have ISIS now is because of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. ISIS is a remnant of al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time. You know, many people say, yes, the people in the region should take responsibility. Absolutely. But also the United States, the one who led the invasion and led to the unraveling of Iraq. And one of the most disastrous decisions was to dissolve the Iraqi army. It was the strongest army in the Middle East with 400,000 troops, and they came with this de-Baathification of basically zero-sum policies, burn things in the ground and start again, and it led to the sectarian policies that we have seen now. And the administration kind of didn't criticize Prime Minister Maliki publicly, so they are to blame there as well. And they left Iraq, and as I think Shane said, the policy of the administration is a wishful thinking, that let's wait and see, and and let the next president deal with it, hoping there's no major disasters going
to happen. You know, one of the questions that has come up over and over again, I'd be interested in your response. Do you have any thoughts as to whether Colin Powell knew before he went to the UN that
Iraq did not have
weapons of mass destruction?
This is a question that has come up many times.
And on your show, I remember
when you talked to him about this quite vividly. You know, it's hard to know inside the mind of one individual. I mean, were there... what I've always come back to on this question, whether it's Colin Powell or anyone else, is this. There was lots of reporting. There was lots of reason for skepticism that got wholly ignored almost. I mean, you know, Walter Pincus and Jonathan Landay and Warren Strobel, I mean, journalists we all know who were writing stories highly skeptical about the claims of WMD, and their stories were pushed off the front page and sort of ignored. I mean, whether or not Colin Powell knowingly ignored intelligence or sort of engaged in a little bit of, you know, wishful thinking, who knows? But there's no doubt that presentation to the UN is what swayed international
opinion.
Well, I think
he has said, I believe, that he was convinced on the information that he saw at the time.
Right, that is what he says.
Yeah. I don't think he has ever said that, you know, he had doubts. I mean, he was convinced by what he saw. The bottom line was the intelligence was faulty.
Yeah, I mean, but the fact that he insisted that the head of the CIA will be, George Tenet, will be behind him, if you remember the UN when he gave that speech. I mean, it gave it some kind of credibility to the world, obviously, that Saddam Hussein has the WMD, and it helped to consolidate the case against him internationally. But definitely, I mean, everybody would agree that the problem that we are facing now is because of the invasion.
And Powell also did, you know, before that speech, go through with his staff and excise the parts of it that he was not willing to say.
That's true.
At the very least, we know he had tremendous uneasiness about this presentation that he was supposed to give. And I think partly because he also knew what the consequences of it would be, which was to,
well, he said, if you break it, you own it.
Yeah,
remember
absolutely.
That
now, he warned about
that
this for sure.
in the beginning.
And that's a whole separate issue. You say disbanding the Iraqi army. To this day, I ask people, senior people, you know, about that issue, and they say that was clearly the worst thing the U.S. did besides invading the country in the first place.
Mm-hmm. All right. To Morgan on Long Island, New York, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Saudi Arabia has the third largest military budget in the world, and they're doing next to nothing. It's in their backyard. Why aren't these right-wing Republicans pushing and saying publicly, instead of complaining to Obama, join with him and get Saudi Arabia to participate in this? It's not Kansas. It's their backyard.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I can't speak for the Republicans and why they're not, you know, questioning Saudi Arabia. What I can say is the Obama administration, I know I've been mentioning John Allen, the retired general, he's been meeting with Saudi officials. Others have as well. They're trying to get them to stop the financing of ISIS, the recruiting, and the fighters crossing their borders. But the bottom line is they haven't had much luck yet.
All right. And to, let's see, Norman, Oklahoma. Hushang, you're on the air.
Hello, Diane, panelists. Just for transparency, I was born in Iran into a Shia family, but for many years I've considered myself human first, a human that happens to be in America second, and a Muslim third. There's a problem with that region, including Israel. The body politic is cancerous with fundamentalism. And I think we do ourselves a disservice not to acknowledge that. When we call Saudi Arabia an ally, there's got to be something that, I mean, there's major problems with that. When we don't insist on Israeli government mistreating of Palestinians, there's something wrong with that.
Well, I mean, allies are not there because of their ethics or morality. Allies are there because they serve national interest. And there is no permanent allies, no permanent enemies in politics. And therefore, the United States have allies from, like, with Pakistan, with Saudi Arabia, with Israel, with, you know, all kind of countries that we might not approve of their politics or internal conduct. But it's worth debating, absolutely. But, I mean, you know, of course, we would love to live in a kind of an idealistic world where morality applies and no double standard in anything. But unfortunately, politics always gets in the way.
How much urging of Saudi Arabia is going on as we speak to try to get them more involved?
I think there's no doubt that we would like to see them doing more. But then again, if you look at their operations in Yemen, where they, you know, can't seem to, you know, hit Houthi targets without blowing up schools, and we've been trying to get them to pull back, I think there's a real question, frankly, about the competency of the Saudi military to take on something like this. They are right now, I think, at least by GDP, the largest procurer of weapons in the world. So they are clearly beefing up their military. Their capability, however, may be leaving something to be desired, I think.
All right. And to Brian in Tallahassee, Florida, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Comment was just made a few minutes ago about the intelligence leading up to the Bush's invasion of Iraq. And a comment was made that the intelligence was faulty. And I think the truth is that what intelligence was not cooked by Vice President Cheney was cherry-picked to enhance the story that the Bush administration was putting out, trying to get draw people or justify going in there. I mean, the story is well known about Cheney planning a story in the New York Times and then going on Meet the Press or whatever and citing that story as an independent source confirming the Saddam's WMD program.
I don't think that point of view will ever cease to be. I just think it does persist. The lack of belief in that so-called evidence.
Absolutely. And I think that what I've always thought seems indisputable is that the administration, the Bush administration, had an objective and did go looking for information to fit that objective. Now, that does not necessarily mean that they did not believe truly that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, but they needed that argument to be true to do what they wanted to do.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Jonathan who says Greece needs to have a 1 or 2% wage freeze to free up money to pay debt if they cannot cut pensions. What more can they do?
I don't know what more can they do. I don't think, as I said, with the country of a history of a very strong trade unionist, I don't think they're going to go for a salary freeze with 1% or 0.5%. It's just a decade of government mismanagement, and I don't know. I mean, they're relying on the big countries to bail them out, like Germany and the
exactly.
EU and the IMF, etc. But they're not willing to pay the higher cost, which is austerity measures that needed to be implemented.
And one last email from Dick in Salisbury, Maryland. Haven't we been training Iraqi troops for over a decade?
We have. The United States has trained them for over a decade. Billions of dollars have been spent. And what you keep hearing from the former trainers, American generals, is that the problem was former Prime Minister Maliki removed a lot of the top commanders, actually more than the top commanders, all the way down to the battalion level, replaced them with political hacks and others. And that was the big reason for the fall of the Iraqi army. But also, I was speaking, we were just talking off here, I was speaking with a retired general who said, listen, give the troops in Ramadi a break. The Iraqi troops had been there for more than a year, didn't get resupplied much. And this guy said, listen, any troops would break if they're stuck in a place for more than a year, not getting resupplied and so forth. So.
Yeah, it's a really dire situation, I think Tom is describing, too. I mean, we would not imagine U.S. forces being in a position where they would be effectively under siege with no resupply coming. I mean, you would have to imagine that they would break. And I think this really does get to the whole question of, you know, what is the U.S. pressure going to be on the Iraqi government to field a military? Not so much on the individual troops, you know, some of them who have fled in the face of ISIS, and there may be reasons why, like Tom's just illustrating. But this is really, ultimately, it is up to the central government, which is what is so maddening about this entire approach. You know, we can't fix this for them much as we might want to.
And what's interesting is we were told back in February that the retaking Mosul would take place in April or May. Now we're not even sure if that will take place this year. Ramadi, I was told 2 weeks ago by people. I said, hey, when are they going to retake Ramadi? This one official said, a couple of days, 2 weeks ago. Now I think they're saying maybe months from now.
And also, if they wanted to create a situation analogous to that of 2005, when General Petraeus came and he said the only way to fight Al-Qaeda, a Sunni-based group, is to enable to arm the Sunnis in Anbar province. Now we're talking about giving them arms and weapons, but everything has to go through the central government. And many people do not trust the central government of making sure the arms goes to them.
I was there back in 2006 when the Sons of Iraq program started. Everybody back then was saying, we're going to pay these guys $300 a month not to shoot at us, and it'll never last under the Shia government.
Tom Homan, Pentagon correspondent for NPR. Nadia Bilbasi of Al Arabiya, Shane Harris of The Daily Beast, and author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. We'll hope to have you back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.